Good morning. Today is a first weekday in October. Yipes. The second. Joining us this morning is Assistant Police Chief, Mr. Brian Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Well, it's, 8:10 in the morning? Haven't had a lot of chance. You know, only got cut off twice driving in. So I guess it's a good day.
It's a good way to start a Monday. You made it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've come up with a new phrase, my internal one. If it's a 96% day, I'm getting frustrated. Only 96% is good. Yeah, yeah. It's normally building up on things. So I don't know. Maybe that would be mainstream in lexicon. Right. I'm still trying to knock down collaborative. I'm not succeeding on that one, though. Are you ready for our question for this morning?
Yeah, let's give it a shot.
All right. Why does a man refer to his wife as his better half? Okay. Why does a man often refer to his wife?
Maybe because some men particularly don't like to be photographed, and so they'll have their better half stand in for them or make sure they're at the front of the photo.
Boy, you only missed that one by 500-600 years. Most men call their wives their better half because they believe it, but the expression comes from an ancient Middle Eastern legend. When a Bedouin man had been sentenced to death, his wife pleaded with the tribal leader that because they were married, she and her husband had become one, and that to punish one half of the union would also punish the half that was innocent. The court agreed, and the man's life was saved by his better half.
So simple.
Sometimes. But I suspect a lot of the police work that you guys do also, we see it as shock and awe and stunned and amazed, and you guys go, yeah.
There's a lot of that, yeah. Just another day.
I just got to move on, and it's...
Just another day.
For the newer folks, or those of us outside the window looking in, what are some of those shock and awe moments that the new guy or gal gets that response to, and then 2 or 3 months into it, it's like, yeah, okay.
Almost every call. I mean, because it's something, you know, you don't deal with. I shouldn't say that. Most people haven't dealt with what officers see in a day-to-day type operation, you know. I mean, we do have employees who have come from troubled roads, I guess, with family issues and stuff, who have seen that, who had cops come to their house, and they bring a different level perspective to the table that's so vital to so many different situations. But for the most part, you don't have cops coming to your house, you know, and even during the worst of times, you know, you're usually able to work through it and come up with a solution or go for a walk. And so, yeah, I mean, when you walk in and it's Thanksgiving dinner and there's mashed potatoes everywhere and they're all family and you're trying to figure out why, and, you know, or it's the, you know, kid that doesn't appear to be dressed properly when it's cold outside, or, you know, just really in the beginning, everything is new to you, and it's, you have to process it and compartmentalize it and figure out a way to deal with it.
Does it become routine or does it become normalized?
I think it becomes more normalized than routine. Routine is not something we try to instill in our officers or in our lives, because nothing truly is routine. No two calls are exactly the same. You have to normalize it so that you can process it and deal with it and not let it weigh on you so it doesn't affect you from call to call to call. That's when we start.
Yeah, I would think the carryover would be early on would be something that it's just human nature.
Yeah, that's where we see that cumulative stress. And then you have, you know, your new officers don't want to say no when it's time to work overtime or when we have special events that we need to cover. So they fill that time that they should be off processing and recalibrating with working overtime because they don't want to say no. So
it's kind of compounds then.
It is. And we're working really hard to try to manage that from within. See that we've lived it, we've seen it. How can we help them manage that stress, manage that time management, and increase their longevity in their careers? That's our goal.
I would think that the personality profile of most badges is suck it up rather than respond and react. You know, so you're not going to vent, typically. You're not going to act out. That's part of what you're looking for, part of the character. is that it doesn't affect you. Well, or at least it doesn't appear like it affects you.
It doesn't affect you externally, so that you don't have those reactions when you're triggered all of a sudden on a call, or is because somebody said something to you that normally would roll off your back. You don't have that reaction, and now we're not doing an investigation for being rude and discourteous to somebody because they were having a bad day. So yeah, it happens all the time, actually. As hard as we try, we all have those bad days where you carry one call to the next, or you have something going on in your personal life that you can't shake at the door when you come to work. And but you know, I mean, that persona of just suck it up is starting to change. We're working hard from the mental health component, from the wellness component of policing, to the stigma is starting to drop, and we have more and more employees that are taking part in our wellness program. We're normalizing having conversations. We're bringing in people to help teach the teams how to have conversations, true, honest, heartfelt conversations among themselves, get to the root issues, get to know each other better so they can help each other better. So there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes.
But when the troops are out in the field, okay, there's no kumbaya moment unless you want to do that with dispatch, and that's probably frowned upon. See, there are certain things I do know and understand. But there's got to be some tricks for them to be able to dismiss those emotions as they're going from one to the next. Learned over time, or is that part of the initial training also?
Yeah, a lot of it's learned over time because you find what helps you release that stress between calls. A lot of it's just that camaraderie between you and your beat partner that were there on that call. Take an extra 2 minutes and talk about that, or talk about something else not related to that call to reset yourself. A lot of people listen to music in their cars and will get back in their car, sit there for a minute before they take off to the next call. So as you go through your career, you'll learn what triggers you, and then you'll learn also what brings you back to that point of, what's it called? A good place. Yeah. A good place.
Centered.
Centered. Yes,
yeah. That's a yeah. Good word for it. Can't use the N-word, that normal thing.
Yes, centered.
That's one thing I keep getting is feedback from, well, pretty much everybody. You know, there is no normal. There's perception of what normal is.
Yeah.
But what is normal, it's like chasing a ghost. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about chicken of the sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Brian Stevens. Had the occasion last week to visit the second floor of the courthouse. Not as what some people might think.
The this wheels was of justice.
A potential juror. Not as, yeah, the box I was in was not that box. Gotcha. different environment. It was intriguing to me, and you probably see it when you get the chance to participate. Even the people that look squirrely take that part serious. It's kind of interesting how circumstances and environment change. Do you see that also, the difference between out in the hallway versus inside the courtroom?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you know, and from our standpoint, we have to be careful wherever we're at up in the second floor, because if there's a jury trial taking place or jury's being picked, we can't be standing there talking about the case, or you don't know who's going to come up to you that you may know and say hi.
Or earlier in the day.
Yeah, and next thing you know, they're sitting on your jury, and then now the case has been dismissed or at least the juror is going to get removed. So, yeah, it's a different world on the second floor for sure. It's usually the cops that go up there are tired. They've been coming off of graveyards a lot lately, and probably really don't want to engage with anyone. So don't take it personally if they're just sitting in the corner trying to stay awake. But yeah, you get your citizens in there for a jury trial, get your family members or your defendants in there, and your jurors, and they're all three sharing sharing the same space for a period of time.
That was one of the bizarre moments I had. I forget what. Oh, this was with Headwaters, so it was a couple weeks earlier. I showed up early because I was going to give the supervisors a pause. What's he doing in here? Before the Headwaters meeting, and it was closed. The meeting went short, so there was no afternoon session. Mm-hmm. So I wandered upstairs. And it was amazing to me, not as part of the juror when I think everybody's kind of on their P's and Q's a little bit, but what is discussed and how it's discussed in the hallway when the various courtrooms are in session. It was really intriguing. I was going to say disturbing, but intriguing is probably a nicer word.
Yeah.
What just kind of flows back and forth, and it's like, gee.
Yeah, deals being made.
Deals.
Between the attorneys and their clients.
Agreements rather than economic transactions.
I
guess it says something when the security guys start saying good morning as you're walking in and you're not an elected or employed. So how do you, as someone who appears far more regularly in that environment than what regular folks do, how do you keep it so that it is at that standard that you would want for a family member or a friend that was in that situation, either being accused of or... Yeah, I guess being accused of.
It's when you get up there, you you got a job to do. And I always try to stay focused on my report to what my task was for, what I was going to be testifying on, be as prepared as I can so that I put on the best case I can for the victim and for the state. And I'm prepared to answer any questions that are asked to me by the defense.
Now, you're not able to read your report, are you?
You can review your report up until you get onto the stand.
So you could actually have a copy of it with you?
And have a copy with you. If they ask you a question and you're not exactly sure the answer, you can ask to refer back to your report, at which time both attorneys can agree to that and the judge can allow you then to turn to a certain page and review what they're asking you.
So it's not just memory? Because I would think some of these cases, if the event happened a number of years ago, a couple things have happened in the interim.
Yeah, and some of our homicide cases will be 300, 400, 500 pages long. When you look at
your report,
I mean the investigator's report. Yeah, you look at like the autopsy reports, you look at the drug reports, you look at the evidence reports that were created, and a certain like in a prelim, we don't call everybody to court to testify in a prelim. So that primary investigator is kind of responsible for, we call it 115, and speaking on the behalf of another person after they've interviewed them. So you kind of got to know their role they played, your role that you played, at least get enough probable cause out there for the judge to say, yeah, we're going to hold you over to trial. So there's a lot of prep that goes into some of the larger cases for court, for sure.
Yeah, that's, and I would imagine the first time that's kind of an educational moment for the young officer, huh?
It is, yeah. When I came up through the courts was back when, Maggie and Wes Keat and Worth Dykeman and Rob Wade.
When I was in the box, Worth was doing the last one that I was on, which tells you how long back it was. And I'm sitting there smiling, and I know it must have bothered some of the other players because I was just flashing back to what had been rather than what was, and so many memories.
Yeah, but they knew how to train you and teach you to be in the – to be on the stand and how to get the most out of the jury and how to get the answers to the right place. And
not for a specific trial, but just in general.
Well, that's how I learned was for a specific homicide trial. My first one was with Worth and Rob Wade. And we had to go out of the area because they wanted to move the jurisdiction out of the area. So we had to go to a hotel. But the night before, we sat and went through, this is how you're going to testify. This is what we're going to ask you. And Worth told me at the time, he goes, you always follow me wherever I go. Because I will get you to talk to the right people without you knowing who you need to talk to. So if it was a question he really wanted the jury to know or answer to, he would lean up against the jury box. So I would look at him, and I'm technically, we look like I'm talking to the jury, personally talking to the jury, because he was in front of the jury box.
Right, because you had
it was something he wanted the defendant to know, that to drive home with the defendant, you know, and the defense attorney, he would walk to the other side. So I would follow him with my eyes and talk, and, you know, and I learned a lot. And that was the great thing, that we had attorneys that could teach us that back then. And, you know, then working at the task force, Maggie was my vertical prosecutor for almost the whole time I was out, to her and Wes Keaton. Just to have that experience to walk you through your cases and get you up to the point to testify as an expert, and then have both sides. You didn't have to tested anymore. It's like you walk in and they're like, yeah, we concede he can testify as an expert. But they took time to mold you into somebody who was good in the courtroom, which helped them and which helped the victims and the state. So,
KINS News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Brian Stevens from Eureka Police Department. Brian, the concept of being in the courtroom, is that something you can role play with your guys? I mean, you mentioned Rob and Worth had taken you aside a little bit, and that was probably routine. It wasn't that you were anything magical, I would...
Yeah. that was routine.
Yeah, okay, good. But for some of the new guys, you know, if there's not enough time to be able to do that, do you have the ability to, like, go up to an empty courtroom, you get to play the attorney and say, this is how it happens, this is what normally occurs, get normal about this? Or maybe, you know, if you have a free half hour, run up to the second floor and just sit and watch and just get to know the courtroom environment.
Yeah, it's more the latter. So our FTOs, when we have recruits on training, will walk them through the court process, how to prep for the case, what's going to be asked of them, what levels of training they need to bring, sure they bring out during their testimony. But then, you know, during that 16 weeks that they're on training, usually their FTO or them are going to get a court case somewhere along that line. It's usually their FTO first. So they do. They do rotate to the courtroom, sit there with their FTO. They walk them through everything they're watching, what's happening, how to act on the second floor, you know, what to do, what not to do, what not to talk about, because you don't know if it's a potential juror sitting with you or a family member, just because you don't know that extent of who could be present.
Somebody within earshot.
Yeah. So they do walk them through all that. I've never had the opportunity, and we've never crossed my mind to go up and get like a training day, but that's I could see us doing that. That's not a bad idea. And we want our people to be prepared, not get caught off guard, and do the best they can. I think that benefits both sides, to be honest with you. It's not just about the prosecution, but it benefits the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if they, you know, there's nothing worse than having a V8 moment, right? Yeah. We've all experienced it, whether it was in school, you know, on a test or something like that, or, you know, the last interaction we've had with a customer or a business. I forgot to get the pepper. You know, obviously the magnitude is a little bit less.
Yeah.
But just to kind of remember to breathe, take it easy, all those types of things that are, I guess, ways to reset.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned something about rude and discourteous, that there are investigations based on that.
Yeah. So
is that just an internal, let's get things together, or is that really something that's far more serious than what it sounded like?
No, it's part of the conduct policy that the department is held to through Lexapol. And, you know, it occurs from time to time. Sometimes it's a part of a larger investigation. Sometimes it's a complaint made by someone who gets a traffic citation and doesn't believe that they did or were treated unfairly during the traffic citation. Or it could be a remark made out of anger, or like during a fight or after a fight, somebody could say something that could be construed as being rude and discourteous behavior. And
doesn't the TV camera on everybody's chest
kind
of eliminate that or confirm that pretty darn quick?
It definitely has cut down on the number of them. And yeah, it's a lot of these investigations, if it's strictly to somebody, you know, submits something and says, hey, this officer was rude to me when he was writing my ticket, that's usually closed in a very short amount of time, whether it was found to be sustained. And yeah, you could have, your bedside manner could have been a little bit better, or I don't know what you're talking about. They caught you speeding. They were saying yes, sir, no, sir, and you were talking over them the whole time. They gave you a citation. That was not rude and courteous. He didn't say anything other than yes, sir, no, sir, sign hard, three copies kind of thing. So you may not have liked the presentation, but is it rude and discourteous?
Or the event.
Or the event altogether, yes. So, you know, we work hard to have our officers maintain a level of professionalism that we want to be representative of the police department. From time to time, and there are things that happen, and we all straddle that line, walk that line on both sides. And we reset people by bringing it to their attention and getting them back on the right track.
Yeah, I would think that that's probably similar in the courtroom setting as well.
Yeah.
You know, just how things, how they play out, and then how they're remembered also.
Yep.
In that courtroom setting, do you role play at all? You're going to be testifying and you're going to say that the color was purple. Okay, fine. Do we role play that on beforehand, or do I, if I'm, I know this is a frightening thought for everybody, if I'm the legal representative, do I say, I'm going to ask you this question, your report said X, you've said that that's the same thing, so that's how you're going to respond, and kind of walk through to that detail?
We hope that a lot of cases, we hope that that is the way it is handled, that we have the time to meet with the prosecutor of the case ahead of time, understand what they've talked about, what their concerns with the investigation may be, the pieces that they feel are truly strong, the pieces we may need to testify and clear up any issues with, so that the judge understands that the probable cause is there.
A little bit more detail.
Yeah, detailed. Yeah. And they will ask you questions. Because, you know, a lot of times we'll submit a case for certain crimes. They'll add certain crimes to the case that they read the report and be like, well, we're going to add these charges to the case. Now we have to testify to the evidence that supports that, which was in the report, but understanding the importance of that evidence to bring out of the case into the courtroom for the judge to have a finding on that particular charge. So, yeah, that interaction's vital, especially for new officers that really want to know what that line of questioning is. And you know what? If you know the first question is going to be, hey, what's your name? Spell your first name, spell your last name, and tell me about your training and experience. At least you got something you can usually knock out of the park and at least get you started on a right, you know, on a good path for the day. But so we can prepare them for a little bit of it for sure. But, yeah, it's great to have that interaction with prosecutors ahead of time to talk about the case. And
do defense attorneys, is one of their strategies that they'll try to do with, I guess, with cops, but with others also, is to kind of hit them with a surprise question and just to see either how you react or, you know, maybe to make you look foolish?
I mean, their job is to create doubt, right? And, I mean, if they can create doubt for a judge or create doubt for a jury, then they potentially could get their client either a mistrial or not held on certain charges. So they will push you at times, try to get you change your answers or question your observations, try to get under your skin, make you frustrated, so then you start stumbling, blundering,
venting,
have an emotional reaction that may look to the jury that, you know, well, look at his reaction he's having to this one question. If he's this angry on the stand,
what's he like out in the
field? What's he out in the field? You know, I mean, just little things like that. But
it's funny, as you were saying that, I'm starting to smile to myself because I know exactly if somebody wanted to get me, there is no question how. Ask the same question five different ways. 10 different ways.
Yeah, and that's where you hope a prosecutor goes asked and answered. Can we move along, Your Honor?
Yeah. Oh, hey. Okay, now that that word is out, it's time for a break. KINS News and Information Time, it's 8:42.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft salad dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:47. We're back talking shop this morning with Brian Stevens, Assistant Police Chief for the City of Eureka. Conduct policy. A little too much electrical in my head right now. conduct policy. Obviously, that has evolved and is one of the more liquid documents and policies you guys and gals adhere to. How much of that is, or is all of it, based on case law and those types of things rather than the press and some of those pressures that come? I mean, obviously, there's a combination of both, but what is the driving force on that? Is it the lawsuits and the legislation that's done, or is it what you see on the nightly news?
That's interesting. I don't think that policy in particular has probably anything to do with either side of that. That policy is truly what the police department, what the profession wants out of their officers. So it's more of, I mean, a lot of it's like no horseplay in an apartment. I mean, it's a wide gamut of like 15 pages of stuff.
What's the most surprising thing that we would go, what?
Oh, jeez.
I mean, you said horseplay in the apartment.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, horseplay.
Okay, I mean, so you don't wrestle with your kid?
That's probably where somebody...
Don't bring the horse into the apartment.
No. That's probably where, you know, maybe not case law, maybe not the press, but that's where it's probably written in there because something happened. There's a story behind most of the things that are in there. So there maybe
Officer
made...
Stevens, answer the question.
So... yeah, but we do have policies that we have seen change, you know, like the carotid restraint being removed from the policy following certain events in the country. And case law does affect some of that. Changes in the law affect some of that. And those are updated as soon as that happens, and we train those out as soon as they get updated within our system. So the press on the other side, you know, they play more of a role in that public perception piece and how they change that. But it truly takes something, an event to happen for changes to really be done. And that is either, like you said, case law, or it's an actual event that happened that we learned from and we don't want to happen again. And if it does happen again, we want to make sure we have a policy in place to protect the department and the employees if it does.
Yeah, reference points.
Yeah.
As much. Yeah, police officer standard and training. Okay. Sacramento is how I think of that.
Yeah.
Do they have... determinants also that they or recommendations or suggestions or hey guys think about different things that they come upon either as they're going through their curriculum or with some of the teachers and faculty that come in to present?
Absolutely. We have post mandates that come down all the time, and these are generally trainings that they recognize as being vital to the success of the profession and making sure that the officers have on the street. De-escalation training, DV trainings mandated every year. And we have a set of trainings that are mandated every 2 years by post. So firearms, driving, de-escalation, use of force. So every 2 years, we have to complete 24 hours of training into a scope of curriculum that post says you will have 24 hours of training into this, and like each class is like 4 hours.
So you don't have to go down, you can do it.
We can get a class certified and have our own instructors. As long as the class is certified by post, meets all the requirements and all the, you know, points that post wants us to meet in the training, we can get our own instructors certified to teach that course. We teach that course, submit to post, and we get our credits for it. Which being so rural and trying to find trainings and the cost to fly out of here to go to San Diego all the time or the Bay Area for trainings, it really does benefit us. And we train on our schedule that way. We don't have to train on somebody else's.
So you prefer San Diego?
San Diego's a nice place to go.
Over downtown Eureka?
I'm going to be in San Diego in a couple weeks. So.
There you are, working on that tan?
No, the international, I don't tan very well, Brian, anymore.
I know, most of us, we just flash
up here,
burn.
Yeah, up here, especially after all these years. The sun's not my friend. Yeah, it's the International Association of Chiefs of Police Conference. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah. When you get together in that scenario or that environment, how different are some of the various jurisdictions? I mean, you said international, so yeah, obviously there's a wide gamut. Yeah. But are you able to pick things up from those, let's say, German, that they're doing there that we've not thought of?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that more in the FBI Academy because we had, you know, 30, 40 different countries represented, and you get to see how policing is done there, and you're like, well, this is a great program. I can see this program maybe working here. At the conference, it's more of internationally, it's kind of tough because they're – you don't have that interaction as much as, you know, you'll go to the elongated time
yeah, with people. Yeah.
But I think with the others that attend the training, the people you sit next to and the people you have lunch with, those conversations, you realize how much policing is the same across the country and everybody's facing a lot of the same challenges. But you do go to some of the classes and walk away with, like, I need to reach back out to them because I think we could implement something like that, or I could look into that for our people here too.
So will they bring in, you know, the only conventions I've been to are my kind.
Yeah.
Will they bring in speakers or experts that are outside of the arena, the profession, that talk to a specific topic? Or is it a lot of the folks that are within the industry that are kind of experts in whatever that topic is or have kind of received recognition for some of that knowledge?
Both, especially if you take them on. They have what they have is like tracks. So you have a small department track, large department tracks. But inside that, you could have legal updates that are being taught by lawyers from Washington, D.C., or you could have experts in the use of force teaching classes. But usually it's somebody in the field, or at least with connection to the field, that has a role to play in the scope and molding of the profession.
It's frightening. You said Washington, D.C. Immediately, I thought, why would there be an FCC presentation to the cops? Oh, wait a minute.
We spent a lot of time on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. Got to clean this stuff up. Thanks for coming by, bud.
Thanks.
See everybody tomorrow.